Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller, and this is the Friday Roundtable. Today, the identity crisis that each political party is trying to solve. Here's Arizona Senator Jeff Flake speaking to that.
When we remain silent and fail to act, when we know that silence and inaction is the wrong thing to do because of political considerations, because we might make enemies, when we succumb to those considerations in spite of what should be greater considerations and imperatives in defense of our institutions and our liberty, we dishonor our principles and forsake our obligations.
That's Senator Flake's diagnosis of what he thinks ails his Republican Party. Senator John McCain and former President Bush are also concerned about what the party stands for. Here's George W. Bush in an October speech.
Bullying and prejudice in our public life sets a national tone, provides permission for cruelty and bigotry, and compromises the moral education of children.
But Democrats are also seeking their reason for being. Time magazine recently asserted, on the surface, the Democratic Party has been united and energized by its shared disgust for Trump. But dig an inch deep, and it's clear that the party is divided, split on issues including free trade, healthcare, foreign affairs, and Wall Street. So as our roundtablers consider the future of the political parties, I'd like to hear from you. If you vote as a member of a political party, what do you want that political party to stand for? And yes, I'm not forgetting those of you who do not belong to a political party. If you don't, tell me why on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Catherine Pearson is with us. She's an associate professor of political science at the University of Minnesota. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Marissa Luna is the communications director for Alliance for a Better Minnesota. Marissa, good to have you on the roundtable.
It's great to be here.
Annette Meeks is a conservative and the founder and CEO of the Freedom Foundation of Minnesota. Annette, long time no see. Good to have you back.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So, Annette, after Jeff Flake and Bob Corker and Bush all decried President Trump's influence on politics, I heard a number of Washington-based political analysts say, well, it's Trump's party. So the Republicans are now influenced and essentially owned by President Trump. You've had your moments with Donald Trump. I wonder if you agree on the face of that, that that's what is true about the party.
I would say he probably is the titular head of the Republican Party nationally. Does he speak for me? No, he does not. Does he speak for a lot of Republicans? I guess I say to Senator Flake and former President Bush, where the heck were you last year when we could have used your help? There were 15 other very, very qualified candidates, most of whom were very conservative, would have been excellent presidents, and we could have used their help last year in uniting the party. And this is what you end up with when you have a fractured party. A plurality candidate was elected. I believe he's remains a very divisive voice in American politics, and I think it's very difficult for the Republicans to define who we are with him as president, because right now he's defining who Republicans are.
Is that right, Catherine, that it's really hard to see who Republicans are because you have this oversized influence of President Trump, even though a lot of Republicans say, well, that's not me?
Well, that's right. The president is always the head of the party, whether or not it was a contentious nominating process or not. I mean, the president is the highest level elected officer in the U.S., and so by default, head of the party. And yes, there are prominent Republicans who have come out and expressed some very serious concerns with the president. But by and large, most members of Congress who are Republicans still support the president. And even though President Trump's approval rating continues to slip and he is the most unpopular president we've seen since polling started, a majority of Republicans still support him.
I mean, that's the thing, Marissa. Democrats would really like to tie Republicans to President Trump, but you see a pretty motivated base that has stood loyally with him, and those people can be very influential in an election season. How do you see this?
I see President Trump as being a representative of the Republican Party.
It's because in its entirety. Want to, or because it's true?
Because it's true. And to kind of further a little bit on Catherine's point, that we've seen so many Republicans at the federal level and even at the state level in Minnesota who do agree with President Trump, who have supported him since he began his run for office and continue to support the types of policies and pushing that agenda on both the national and state levels. So he really is a representative of what the overall Republican Party does stand for.
So, Catherine, given what Marissa just said, what's the lesson then from the Virginia governor's race, where a Republican who somewhat at the last minute embraced some of Trump's techniques and views ended up losing?
Well, what we know from decades of political science research is that the party of the president always fares poorly in elections following the presidential election. So whether that's the governor's races a year later or the midterm elections 2 years later, with only three exceptions in the contemporary era, the president's party loses seats in Congress. And Virginia is a state that supported Clinton, not Trump. And so while Democrats won bigger than was anticipated, and I think Democrats are rightfully excited about that, the victory itself really was not that surprising.
What do you take away, Annette, from Gillespie's loss in Virginia?
When you look at the numbers from Tuesday night, Eddie really didn't even hold his own in comparison to just 1 year ago with the Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump election. And it's very difficult to win an election with Northern Virginia so dominating the state. You have all the government employees, all the government union employees. It's just a very difficult state for Republicans. And Eddie did far better 4 years ago when he ran for the Senate than he did, or excuse me, 3 years ago than he did on Tuesday evening.
Marissa, question for you. Until a few years ago, Donald Trump donated to Democratic candidates, I think voted as a Democrat when he voted in a few elections. If he's remaking the Republican Party into a bigger tent, and he says he is, and there seem to be some numbers that might support that, what does that mean for Democrats?
I think that more people are seeing what's happening with, for example, the divisive rhetoric that Republicans and Trump have been using, the attacks against working people, trying to, for example, take away millions of Americans' health care. And I think a lot of people are being woken up by that and energized by the fact that these actions are having real life implications on people's everyday lives, and that they now are recognizing, I think, more than ever, that they need to be getting out there and voting and taking action and doing something if we're going to stop these attacks from happening.
So I've been reading some analysis, Catherine, that he is bringing people into the party who might have potentially voted Democratic or who sit out these elections, his popularity polling notwithstanding. Do you see evidence of that? And what does that mean for both parties?
Well, there's no doubt that there was a shift among white working class voters, particularly in the Midwest, who voted for Trump after voting for Obama in one or two elections. But by the same token, Hillary Clinton did win the popular vote by almost 3 million votes. And Trump is really costing the Republican Party the opportunity to extend its reach with people of color. We saw it when George Bush was president, we saw not a majority, but large numbers of Latinos in the 40% range enthusiastically supporting George Bush. And those numbers have plummeted with every election since, even as people of color are growing to be a bigger part of the U.S. population.
I mean, what it seems to have happened, Annette, in 2016 is he activated some of these white voters who perhaps normally wouldn't have voted, right, or who might have voted Democratic, and that overwhelmed the voters who didn't turn out. Can
right,
he keep doing that? Yeah, what's your analysis?
Well, it's an interesting shift because the Republican Party for the last probably three, four presidential elections was the party of the South, was what everyone always said, a
right.
Southern white conservative, also with some Latino voters and a few other minority voters that dominate states like Florida, Texas, states like that. But what he did was so different in the sense that he took some of the Rust Belt states and the industrial Midwest and plowed ahead in states that no one gave him a chance, so much so that the Clinton campaign totally ignored Wisconsin and gave it to Trump. Ohio, you look at some of the Rust Belt areas there in Pennsylvania, and you see the ginormous numbers that Trump racked up that no one saw coming. And it makes it a very interesting realignment, if you will. I look at Minnesota and the numbers in the Iron Range. I never dreamt that a Republican would carry Hibbing, Minnesota. I never dreamt that we had counties up there where we would rack up 60% of the vote for a Republican nominee. So I think that gives us a unique opportunity as Republicans to talk about a realignment, and we're no longer the party confined to the South. We have other opportunities in states that many in the Republican Party gave up on years ago.
Marissa, that's got to be worrying to Democrats and organizations like yours.
I think it's more of an opportunity for us as well to really think about how we can be articulating our values in a better and clearer way, because we are a organization and Democrats are a party that do value working people, that value people in communities of color, and ensuring that there's opportunity for everyone in the state and nationally as well.
So let me ask, just on what you just said there, what is it that you think was not being communicated to these communities that you've just talked about that normally would have been in Democrats' back pocket? What wasn't said?
And a clear articulation of what our values actually are. And also needing to be having folks running for office who are also reflective and representative of communities of color and people that we say that we represent. Young people like myself, Latinas, actually having those people on the ballot, running for office. I think that is critically important, that we are reflected in our elected officials and in government, and showing that government is by us and actually for us, and that we are in that is something that I think is missing and that is very important to be happening, as well as transparency and not having, you know, these backroom deals and keeping things out of the public eye.
The Clinton Sanders thing?
About policies and decisions that are being made. That needs to be out front, especially in the age of social media. We're all paying so much more attention all the time, 24/7 plugged in, and people really want to know what's going on and have honesty there.
Catherine, what are you hearing what Marissa just described about what didn't go right, in 2016 and since?
Well, I think there was an assumption on the part of Democrats that by highlighting some of the more egregious things that Donald Trump was saying, that that would be motivating to people and that would help win elections, as opposed to talking about the economy. And even though Democrats did talk about the economy,
I mean, I have to be fair to Hillary Clinton.
Lost.
She did actually talk about the economy. She made a lot of campaign stops where she talked about it. Why did it get lost?
She did. But if you actually look at content analyses, you see that that was drowned out by a lot of the very memorable attacks that she launched against Trump. And so from
deplorables come to mind.
Well, right. And so from her perspective, you can understand why you would think that criticizing Trump is a good strategy. But I think that voters were wanting to hear more about change, more about the economy, even though she was, I agree, talking about those things, the message got lost. The other dynamic that I think is important is that if you look at political science models that were conducted well before the first vote was cast, well before the campaigns were really even underway, they were pretty much tied as to whether or not the Democratic or the Republican candidate would win. Not on the basis of any characteristics about the candidate, but on the basis of President Obama's popularity, economic growth, and the desire for change after 8 years of a Democrat in the White House. And so it was always going to be a very competitive election.
You're listening to a Friday roundtable on politics that takes note of the year since Donald Trump was elected president, that also takes note of the fact that both of the main major political parties are going through this kind of search for identity, taking what they learned about what voters said in the 2016 election and then the year since then to say, well, who are we and how do we respond to what voters actually want? Marissa Luna is with us. She's Communications Director for Alliance for a Better Minnesota. Annette Meeks is here. She's a conservative. She's the founder and CEO of the Freedom Foundation of Minnesota. And Catherine Pearson is an associate professor of political science at the University of Minnesota. You were taking notes, Annette. What do you want to say?
Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about the 3 million plus votes that Mrs. Clinton carried in the popular vote.
Yes.
That if you break that down, it really is the East Coast and the West Coast. And when you look at what was up for grabs, as Professor Pearson just said, models showed that this was a change election, and it was a change election before there were names before the Republican and the Democrat nominees.
Explain what you mean by that.
Well, that people were had 8 years of President Obama, and they were interested in change. They were interested in things that pertain to their daily lives. And when we talk about the economy, one thing, yes, Mrs. Clinton did talk a lot about the economy, but what drowned all that out were all the extraneous things that were happening. And that's part of being a good, running a good, responsible campaign, and she didn't. Neither did Trump, I can add, but his was just a little bit more successful when all the votes were counted on Election Day. But some of the stuff that had been said before allowed independents and former Democrats to take a look at both candidates from a new point of view. When you call people deplorables, when you say that people are clinging to their guns and religion, and those are who conservatives are.
And that was Obama, by the way.
Correct.
But, I mean, 4 years before that.
Well, and during his last term, if you'll recall, he made a very impassioned speech about your business. You didn't build that. And there were lots and lots of small businessmen and women throughout the entire Midwest that said, by God, yes, I did. This is my business. But it gave them an opportunity to break out of those traditional voting patterns and take a look at what Trump was saying. And I can't tell you how many people I've talked to in the course of the last 12 months who have said, I don't agree with everything he said. Actually, I don't agree with 50% of what he said, but at least he was trying to change things. And that is the message I hear over and over again, is it was a vote, almost a protest vote, a vote for change and a vote for trying something else.
Marissa, what do you hear in that?
I think that Trump really kind of spoke to people's very deep fears, especially like their financial fears, fears of not having economic security that most Americans have now, and also really unconscious biases and prejudices against other groups of people. And I think that that was something that he was constantly trying to appeal to in his campaign and was a motivating factor for a lot of folks, whether consciously or not. And it actually, at the end of the day, is driving more division and more divisiveness in our country rather than bringing us together.
Catherine?
So a couple of points. One, research has shown on vote choice and sort of extensive surveys of voters that Trump indeed did sort of capitalize on racial resentment among whites, and that that was part of the reason for his success in both the nominating contest and in the general election, and that economic concerns were also prevalent, and that it was indeed a change election. So I think that all of these things help us understand what goes on. But it's also important to remember that 9 out of 10 partisans in both parties voted for their party's candidate. And so in that way, the election really was not that unusual. Everything about the campaign trail was unusual. But in terms of people's actual vote choice, 89% of Democrats voted for Clinton and 90% of Republicans voted for Trump.
I think this is such an important point because you still hear people, a lot of dissatisfaction with the infrastructure of the parties. But they all, you're saying, ultimately, at least for now, they come home to the party.
Yes. Partisan ID is an extremely strong attachment for most voters in the U.S., not for all. But most public opinion polls sort of misrepresent independents because they suggest that, oh, a third of the electorate suggests that they're independents.
Right.
Well, the good polls actually, once someone identifies as an independent, then asks, but if you lean toward one party or the other, which party is it? And if that person gives a party, and all but about 10% do, then that party that they lean toward very reliably predicts their vote choice.
Usually they're going to the polls on election day and they're going to their leaning place.
Exactly.
Yeah, Annette?
Well, the other thing that's interesting to feed off something Marissa said is this was a change election about so many people's financial insecurities. We keep reading over and over again that most or many Americans are within $400 away from financial ruin. And when you talk to those people in depth and really listen to what their concerns are beyond what some may suggest is a racial prejudice. They're really concerned about, will my kids have a chance? Will my kids get an education that allows them to live better than I am? And for the first generation since the baby boom generation, we have people who are not going to have as successful a life as their parents. And that causes a lot of anxiety, a lot of people to reconsider the way things are going in this country. And I think a lot of that anxiety fed into the election of Trump, which is there's got to be a better way. We've got to try something else.
Catherine?
There's no doubt that this anxiety is an extremely important factor in politics right now. I very much agree with that. But if you look at studies, people filter their view of what will solve the economy based on their partisan leanings. Mm-hmm. And so someone who is feeling that anxiety, their view of what's going to help it, for the most part, will be heavily influenced by the party that they are already attached to. Now, in the case of independents or people who don't follow politics very closely, that's where some of the influence can come. But most of the people who are feeling this economic anxiety, it will shape their vote based on their previously existing partisan attachment.
I think I would disagree just a little bit, though, on the Trump election, which is we also had a group of people, many of whom are in northeastern Minnesota and north central Minnesota, who did change party alliances last time because they are so greatly concerned about their economic future and, frankly, the viability of even their communities surviving over the next decade or two. They see a real problem that no one is talking about. And they, for once, listened to both sides and thought, I think I agree with Trump a little more. At least he's willing to try something.
Marissa, you're the generation that Annette is speaking to, I think, with am I going to do as well as my parents did, and some and student loan debt and a lot of that economic insecurity. Be candid here. Do you think Democrats have figured out a way to speak to those kinds of concerns, which seems to drive a lot of political choices here for your generation?
Yes, I'm definitely thinking about it.
What would you say?
Just kind of from my perspective,
yeah,
as a millennial and as a young person who does have bills. I have a lot of student loan debt, as many people my age do, that is constantly kind of driving a lot of my decisions that I make in my everyday life. I think that Democrats could be doing a better job at articulating kind of what are the steps forward that we can be taking as a society to be lessening some of the debt, or what are the solutions to make sure that people aren't getting into debt in the first place. And I believe that people are starting to recognize now with, you know, the Trump administration and the actions that congressional Republicans have been taking, that that is the party of billionaires. I mean, the tax bill that has come out would, for example, eliminate student loan deductions. And that would be such a huge blow to people like me who are trying to pay off this debt. And I think that that's going to be a big factor in people recognizing what the Republican Party, continuing to recognize what the Republican Party stands for. And I think that on the opposite end of that, Democrats need to have that solution and clearly articulate the solutions to these problems that we're facing in a way that will motivate us to take action and to do something about our futures.
Catherine, do you hear, I mean, this is part of the who are we search of Democrats and Republicans. I mean, do you hear Democrats responding to the true concerns of the next generation of potential Democrats?
I mean, I think Marissa's onto something when she talks about the tax bill. And I think that Democrats' responses tend to be in the weeds policy-wise and critical of what Republicans are doing.
Yes.
But Democrats need to create their own message that is a little bit sharper and a little bit more focused. But one of the things that's going on here is that parties are really creatures of the elected officials that populate them.
Uh-huh.
You know, we think about, you know, the RNC chair, the DNC chair, and some of these important contests. But really, when Americans think about political parties, they're thinking about elected leaders. They're not so much thinking about the chairs of various parties. And so within both parties, there's some disagreement over how to prioritize these issues, over exactly what the solutions are. So I think for both parties to be stronger, they need a stronger bench of leaders who are articulating particular messages, not better platforms within the party organization, but actually leaders who are more responsive at the individual level.
You know, I hear you say that, and then I think of the paralysis in Congress. If that's who Americans associate as party leaders, there isn't much to show for doing anything.
Well, I think there will be.
Yeah,
I think the tax bill will actually work in Republicans' benefits in several ways. Number one, the Democrats' response is, we're not Trump. Okay, that takes you only so far. Let's talk
right.
about ideas, because that's what the tax bill is all about. Different ideas on how to solve our economic growth problem, how to solve people who don't get ahead, people who are amassing enormous amounts of debt that will prohibit them from being homeowners and other things that we associate generally with the American middle class. It's about all those ideas, and all the the Democrats in Washington do is trot out Pelosi and Schumer, who I think are both over 70. And they're not exactly speaking to the millennial generation. They're saying the same thing they said 20 years ago when they were in power in Congress and didn't solve this problem.
Bernie Sanders is over 72. And for some reason, he motivated a lot of people like Marissa. I mean,
I'm sorry, he's still a cranky old socialist. And for, you know, whoever they want to trot out, they need some new ideas. And they need ideas that are relevant to the younger generation of millennials that are graduating college, looking at ginormous amounts of debt that I think are just staggering in terms of what they're going to do with the rest of their lives and how they're going to live the American dream.
I want to ask you this, though, Annette. And again, I don't think you voted for Trump, or did you in the end?
I did
very
vote
reluctantly
for Trump.
Okay. But you don't like him?
Not much.
Okay. So if Republicans didn't have the White House, would you be saying Republicans have all the great ideas and we're really putting them into action and I can see how this will build the foundation for the next generation of Republicans? Or do you look at Republicans and say, where are the new ideas too?
Well, I guess it depends on the issue, to be very blunt. On tax reform, I have been enormously excited about what they're putting forward. New ideas, new proposals that haven't had a hearing in decades. Some of them have never been tried before. I think that's a remarkable opportunity for Republicans to talk about and hopefully implement some new growth-oriented tax changes. Do I think we had new ideas on health care? Heck no. And that's why it failed. We were trying the same proposals that we've tried for the last 8 years to stop Obamacare, and it doesn't work. We need to rethink health insurance and how we deliver health insurance in this country, not just keep saying we're not for Obamacare.
Yeah, Catherine.
Reducing the tax burden is an issue that Republicans, by and large, agree on. I mean, this is one of the issues that defines the Republican Party. But I think Annette sort of overstates the possibility for major tax reform. Yes, the House and the Senate have a bill. The House is marking it up this week. But there's a lot of uncertainty about what this final bill will look like. And while I think that Republicans would likely be able to agree on some tax cuts, I think the prospects for major reform aren't great for Republicans, even though they control the White House and both chambers of Congress, and they have set this up to have tax reform go through the reconciliation process, so it would only require 51 votes in the Senate. It is striking to me that we're not quite a year into Trump and the Congress, but it is remarkable how unsuccessful they have been thus far at passing anything in Congress, even through the reconciliation process. With unified party control, which is relatively rare in Washington, there are obviously still obstacles, but the obstacles are coming from within the Republican Party, not from Democrats.
So, Marissa, when you hear Annette say she's not, Democrats appear to just be coalescing around "we aren't Trump," do you agree with that? And does that raise some red flags for you that it's a comfortable place to be and it doesn't force the Democratic Party to really do the kind of hard soul searching that I think we've been talking about?
We definitely want to be making the distinction "we aren't Trump." Obviously, that's very important to be kind of drawing that line, because there is that line there and that division in ideas and values. I don't think that it's necessarily an issue for Democrats of needing new ideas. I think that Democrats have always been the party of working people, have been working for the betterment of everyone. I think that what needs to be happening more so is actively listening to individuals and to voters, especially, again, to go back to kind of my millennial age group, folks my age, for example, who maybe aren't as entrenched in politics, don't know as much. From what I've been hearing from a lot of folks around the state here is that they want someone who will really just listen to their struggles as one major aspect of what isn't happening and hasn't been happening well. And also, to go on the same note of not necessarily that we need new ideas, but I think we need to speak to people's lived experiences better and to kind of meet people where they are and see where they're struggling, and then articulate the great ideas that already exist in a way that speaks to people and that then drives them.
Give me an example of that.
Student loan debt is huge. And so there are a lot of different, you know, proposals that are really wonky out there that Democrats have put out, you know, whether it's reducing debt somehow or making college free or making college more affordable. The ideas are all great, because at the end of the day, it's about trying to make sure that people are able to get an education and to better their lives and their lives for their families without going into massive debt.
So why wasn't
takes over their lives.
Why do you think Hillary Clinton wasn't? I mean, you know, there was a big fight. I did a show about it between Sanders and Clinton on this idea of free college, and a lot of the details didn't really back up the plan, right? Because you're going to have states that were never going to appropriate that kind of money for it. But what happens to an idea like that? It seems like it gets subsumed in the argument over the wonky details, as you put it.
I think that the ideas get subsumed in wonky details, and that is not something that, like, the average person has the time to be constantly processing and thinking about.
Yeah.
And so it needs to be laid out in a much better and clearer way that is values-based, that is speaking to people's values about their families and how is this actually going to help you as an individual and your family and your community to thrive and to better your life.
This is interesting, Catherine, because the first thing the journalists do is, like, what are the wonky details here? I mean, we want the and it became clear that,
right,
let's just say free college was going to be a very difficult thing to carry out. But Marissa makes a good point about talking about ideas like that through the values that the party stands for.
I think that's right. And there is a big difference on the way that things are framed on the campaign trail and the way that they're framed in the legislative process.
Right.
And Hillary Clinton, I think, was already thinking about the legislative process and sort of the compromises and all of the stakeholders and the states and groups and sort of, you know, what the best case scenario could be. Already sort of thinking in that way. But Donald Trump was sort of only thinking in not about this issue specifically, but just in talking about sort of his ideas and not thinking about the process at all, which worked very effectively for him on the
right.
campaign trail.
Yeah.
But when he was elected and then said healthcare is complicated, Republican leaders complained pretty openly that he did not engage in those wonky details. And the result was an issue that Republicans had campaigned on for years, repealing and replacing Obamacare, did not come to fruition, even though they had enough Republicans to pass it with no Democratic votes.
Annette?
Well, I would say that Obamacare is not dead. It will come back up in another.
Wait a minute, you mean repealing it?
Right. The
okay.
repealing of the bill as it was proposed earlier this year in several different iterations in both the House and the Senate. But I want to talk a little bit more about using the idea of an election as a way to educate voters.
Uh-huh.
And something Marissa said that I thought was very important is that you have to meet the voters where they are. And most voters, when Bernie Sanders said, "I want free college tuition for everyone," thought, "That's doggone nuts."
Yeah.
And you keep talking about things
like that.
Wait a minute,
like most voters thought that?
Oh, I think a lot of people thought, well, how about center to center right voters thought, "That's pretty nuts and you'll bankrupt the country." And shouldn't we instead be talking about alternatives or affordable alternatives to four-year degrees? There's many states that have been experimenting with affordable four-year college, public college degrees. That's something we should encourage. They've also been encouraging other students that maybe a four-year degree isn't what you need to achieve what it is you wish to do with your life, and start looking at vocational technical education and making that more affordable and certainly an option for kids who don't want a four-year degree and they're not going to go on and get a master's degree or go to law school. There are alternatives, and I think the politicians that you'll see rising through the ranks, especially through the 27 Republican governors that we currently have, are alternatives like that that they're experimenting with in the states, which is what they should be doing. It's not going to come from Washington. It's not going to come from a tax bill that does or doesn't allow the tax deductibility of college debt. As we used to say in the halls of Washington, what's done is done. Let's talk about the future. And those who are willing to talk about the future and those governors who are willing to, I know Texas, Indiana, have all done remarkable work in experimenting with affordable college degrees. Those are going to be the governors that are going to rise to the top.
This is really, you've set me up very nicely for the rest of the conversation. You're listening to a Friday roundtable. It is a politics roundtable taking note of the year since Donald Trump was elected president, of some elections this week in New Jersey and in Virginia, of Democrats to the governor's seat, what's happening with state legislators. And I want to talk about that on the other side of news, what we're seeing, if, as Annette is right, that Washington is paralyzed and the big and new and fresh, exciting ideas are happening in states and perhaps in cities. What does that say to the identities of our major political parties? We'll get a look at the latest news and then we'll continue our conversation.
From Minnesota Public Radio News, I'm John Wanamaker. President Donald Trump and Russia's President Vladimir Putin have shaken hands at a summit in Vietnam. The two leaders were spotted on video greeting one another ahead of an Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit dinner that being held in the coastal city of Da Nang. Trump and Putin were expected to hold a formal meeting on the sidelines of the summit, but as Trump was about to land on Friday, the White House announced no meeting would take place. Some establishment Republicans who never supported Roy Moore for Senate in Alabama are calling on him to quit the race if allegations in a Washington Post story are true. The story alleges sexual misconduct with minors decades ago. It's an issue that threatens to rob Republicans of what was supposed to be a safe Senate seat. Moore denies those allegations. And comedian Louis C.K. is accused of sexual misconduct towards several women. The New York Times reports a group of four comedians allege the Emmy-winning star of FX's Louis either pleasured himself in front of them, asked to do it, or did so over the phone. A fifth unidentified woman also details her allegations against C.K. to the paper. And a second Minnesota lawmaker faces allegations of sexual misconduct. Representative Tony Cornish of Vernon Center, a Republican, joins DFL State Senator Dan Schoen in facing accusations of inappropriate behavior. We'll have more on that coming up at the top of the hour with Stephen John. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
I'm Mike Edgerly, executive editor at NPR News. We recently surveyed hundreds of Minnesotans about how they feel about their lives and the future of our state. Next week, tune in for a series of reports based on what we heard. We call it Ground Level.
I'm Tom Weber. Friday on NPR News, North Dakota Senator Heidi Heitkamp joins me to discuss her new bill that aims to address the crisis of murdered and missing Indigenous women. It's called Savannah's Act. We'll discuss it at 11.
Programming is supported by Concordia College in Moorhead, where career preparedness, from exploration to experience, begins the moment students arrive on campus and continues throughout their 4 years. More at concordiacommitment.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to the Friday Roundtable. Today, it's a roundtable about the identity crisis that each political party is trying to solve. It's a roundtable that takes note that it has been a year since Donald Trump was elected president as a Republican. I'm asking you, as we talk about what this means for the future of the political parties, if you vote as a member of a political party, what do you want that political party to stand for? How attached are you to the idea of being a Republican or Democrat or even independent who leans and votes with one of those parties? And if you don't belong to a party, tell me why. You can talk to me about it on Twitter. Right now, it's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, M-P-R. Catherine Pearson with us from the University of Minnesota. Marissa Luna with us for Alliance for a Better Minnesota. Annette Meeks with us from the Freedom Foundation of Minnesota. Annette, I'm going to come right back to you on this idea that Washington, by their own hand, becoming less and less relevant, and the action is in the states. What does that mean for the parties?
Oh, I think it means it portends great things for most Americans. How's that? That I think that the states were set up to be the great American experiment where we allow ideas to foster at the local level and develop and sometimes retune, refine, sometimes just get rid of them all together. But it's the opportunity for states to innovate and try and do what's best for their population, not necessarily what's best for people in Texas, but here in Minnesota to experiment. And I think we're going to see more and more of that as Republicans have overwhelmingly taken control of state legislative bodies and 27 governorships. You see a lot of experimenting in some of these really important areas like higher ed and especially in health and human services.
Upside and downside of that, Catherine.
Well, it is true. States are, quote, often called the laboratories of democracy. And one of the things that we're seeing today is, yes, more Republican-dominated states, but also more states with unified party control. So the other, you know, many states with unified Democratic control as well, in fewer states like Minnesota today, which have a governor of one party and a legislature of another. And in today's partisan polarized environment, that means that unified party control in a state is more likely to produce a lot of legislation. And this can mean innovation. This can mean some good ideas that work particularly well for states. But this can also mean some bad ideas and a lack of federal protection. And so I think there's an important balance. And as our parties sort of embrace different solutions and different ideas, I do think attention from the federal level to what's going on in states is important.
You know, Annette, just to say this, I think this has been interesting when you talk about the innovation and the experimentation. You look at a state like Oklahoma or you look at Kansas and you see unified, I think, legislative control, and you see some Republican governors there trying to put through ideas that have been the core of the Republican Party, and you see some of them not working. I mean, is that a valuable a part of this kind of experimentation that you're talking about?
It's really valuable. Kansas is a great example. Right. I'm glad you brought that up. Kansas went forward with some pretty wild tax cuts, 6 years ago?
Under Governor Brownback.
Correct, who's still their governor.
Right.
And with the Republican unified House and Senate, they enacted what I call half of the ledger. They ignored the other half, which is if you're going to make significant tax cuts, you might also look at expenditures. And they didn't. And they paid quite a price for that and have been fighting over, for example, K-12 funding in the courts ever since. And so that's a great example of, and by the way, there's plenty of federal agencies that have oversight to make sure civil rights and other problems are certainly always taken care of and not overlooked. But it's a great opportunity to look at, could you implement broad-based tax cuts? Their goal in Kansas is to eliminate the state income tax. They make no bones about that. How they're going about it, though, has been pretty, I don't want to call it reckless, but certainly not very effective, and has caused them to step back, repeal some of the more wild-eyed ideas they had, and do it a little more thoughtfully. And I think that's a great lesson for all conservative legislators going forward, that sometimes you have to look at both sides of the issues, in this case, both sides of the ledger. And more importantly, you have to do it with the big picture in mind, that this isn't for 1 year, this is for forever. And when you're doing those kind of cuts and balances, it's wise to do it very prudently.
Catherine, what do you see in this? And then to Marissa with the cities.
Well, again, we've seen during the divided party government in Washington, when President Obama was president for 6 years, he worked with the Republican Congress and not a lot got done at the federal level. And so we really saw states innovate, sort of take the lead, especially when they were unified party control on one side or the other. But now we actually do have unified party control in Washington. And so I really just want to underscore the fact that when Republicans elected a Republican president and Republican Congresses, they had expectations that they would follow through on many of their campaign promises because there wasn't another party standing in the way. Democrats are in the minority in both chambers. And so that isn't happening. And so, yes, states have this opportunity. But I think if Republicans continue on this path in Washington of not passing major legislation and of Trump attacking Mitch McConnell, his Republican leader in the Senate, and, you know, this notion that there are going to be primaries of Republicans who aren't supportive enough of Trump, it's going to decay the Republican Party reputation.
So, Marissa, we had two big city mayoral elections this week as well. Do Democrats look to mayors to step into the vacuum that I actually think we all agree on from Washington, that's not where innovation is happening? Tell me how you see the role of the cities and the city leaders.
I think that at the more local levels and at the state levels of government, the kind of the party values really can actually come to life because, as Catherine was saying, there's a lot of gridlock. You know, at the federal level, things don't happen as rapidly as they might and do at state level, with state level policy, with city level policy. So I think that it is a way to clearly show that this is what this party's values are coming to life, that is having a much quicker and much direct impact on everyday people's lived experiences. And I think in the case of, for example, elections that took place on Tuesday, St. Paul elected the first African American mayor of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And the first transgender woman of color was elected to U.S. office here in Minnesota. Very exciting stuff that's happening. And I think that is a sign of what voters that are coming out and that are participating in these elections, like I said earlier, want to see the representation of their communities and themselves and want to see representation of the diversity that is across Minnesota and America. And I think that's coming to life in these local elections, which is very hopeful and promising and optimistic.
I was under the impression, though, the Democrats are still struggling with what is known as identity politics to some degree, and the elections that you just described fit into that? I mean, that seems to be part of the debate, I should say, going on within the Democratic Party about who they're going to be to win national elections.
I think it goes back to what I said earlier about needing to speak to individuals' experiences, mm-hmm. and especially not just kind of homogenizing whole groups of people based on, for example, their ethnicity, race, sexual orientation, but really getting to the individuals themselves and what are your hopes and dreams and what is it that you want for your community as this identity that you hold as, for example, maybe a Latina or a young person, and speaking to those individual lived experiences is something that I don't think is being done as well as it should be.
Annette?
I think what happened earlier this week, and especially Minneapolis, was very symbolic of what the DFL in Minnesota has become, which is a mile wide and an inch deep. Minneapolis is a city in crisis. I live in downtown Minneapolis. I run a business in downtown Minneapolis. And you only have to spend about half a day to realize the problems that our city has have been a long time coming, but have been ignored by the current administration. And that's why so many of them were tossed out on Tuesday night. We have a very real crisis in the city, and the current administration has responded by doing symbolic gestures like we're going to pay everybody $15 an hour. Good luck with all the small businesses that will be fleeing the city when these ordinances take effect. They've done ridiculous things like we're for a green economy. We're going to force you to get rid of polystyrene food containers. Come on. We've got serious problems in our city, and we're dealing with these symbolic measures that really do very little or trim very little around the edges to change the way and direction our city is headed.
So question for you. When you say that it's a city in crisis, do you mean quality of life?
What is the
crisis?
Crime, okay. Crime, job creation, the crime level in downtown Minneapolis, the feeling that you have when you walk down any of the main thoroughfares, whether it's Marquette, Nicollet Mall, or Hennepin Avenue. It's truly frightening. I walk to and from work every day. I see open-air drug markets. I see people slumped over from heroin overdoses. I've seen every kind of human degradation you can imagine. And we have a city that virtually ignores that because we're worrying about polystyrene food containers.
Marissa, what are you hearing that?
I don't think that those are meaningless symbolic things. I don't think that things like ensuring that people are being paid living wages for their jobs and for working 40 hours a week is just a meaningless symbolic gesture or policy agenda. I think that those are things that have a direct impact on people's lives, and we know that people are struggling financially. Something like a $15 minimum wage or raising a minimum wage and ensuring that people are being paid living wages is incredibly important in ensuring that we are protecting the planet and protecting our lakes and our parks, especially in Minnesota, where people value these things so much, even more so, I would say, than other parts of other states in the country. Those aren't just meaningless policy agendas. Those are things that people actually care about here. And I think that they are important, and that, yes, other issues, there are always going to be other issues that need to be addressed, but those are what impact people's daily lives. So we have to be thinking about, is this actually helping people in the community, in the city directly?
Catherine, I know your focus is Congress, but I wonder if you see some of the city, again, given the paralysis of Congress, mm-hmm. if you see cities giving rise to this next generation of political leaders.
Oh, there's no doubt that political leaders come from mayor's offices, maybe they start in city council offices, and that local leadership is extremely important. And the Democratic Party, there's no doubt, has a problem with its bench, having lost so many seats in the Senate, the House, and legislatures and governor's mansions since the 2008 election. And so getting Democratic leaders that are coming from urban areas with real leadership experience, I think, is important to the Democratic Party as a whole. But it's also important to remember that over the last couple of decades, there's been a real nationalization of party politics. I mean, it used to be that party leaders coming from different parts of the country or different regions, rural versus urban versus suburban, had very different sort of priorities and issues, and that the Democratic Party has always been a more diverse party on this score than the Republican Party. So I think for us to expect that there's going to be sort of agreement among people of one party coming from different parts of a state or a country is just sort of overlooking our history of political parties. I mean, there are only two major parties in the U.S., and so they each have to encompass bigger tents than they are right now.
I,
I will say.
And that's why there's the struggle, right?
That's one of the reasons, yes.
I like to close my roundtables to find out what you're reading. So, Annette, you look like you've been on vacation. You've got a you've got a sun-kissed face. What did you read on vacation, Annette?
Oh, gosh, I'm so ashamed. Well, I read a terrific book that your readers might enjoy, Charlie Sykes, who was a talk radio host out of Wisconsin,
right.
How the Right Lost Its Mind.
Uh-huh.
I couldn't recommend that book more. Fabulous for Republicans like me trying to find our way.
Yeah, what's he saying that really spoke to you?
Basically, he's saying, I'm not Trump, and our party isn't Trump. We're conservatives. This is what we stand for, and we've got to get our voice back and not be ashamed to stand up. The other thing I read, I'm so ashamed to tell you this. I read The Assassination of Gianni Versace.
Oh.
The story of the Andrew
Cunanan. There's a movie
Cunanan.
Coming about that.
Yeah.
Okay. Don't be ashamed.
I could have saved 450 pages and watched the made-for-TV movie.
There you go. Marissa, what have you been reading?
So I've been reading. I find that when Trump is tweeting, I'm needing to maybe feel like I need to restore my faith in humanity a little bit.
Okay.
I like to pick up The Sun magazine, an independent literary magazine out of North Carolina. And it's filled with short stories and poems and reader submissions that I really love.
Well, how did I miss this? This sounds really good.
It's great. I think
Sun
you'd
magazine.
Like it.
Okay, mm-hmm. Excellent. Catherine, how about you?
Well, I'll spare the readers all the political science research that I'm reading. But okay. I just read a book that's been out for a while, The Glass Castle by Jeanette Walls.
Oh, my gosh.
I think is a movie. I don't know how to say movies, but the book is so good. It's a story about resilience and family, and it's a wonderful book.
One of the best contemporary memoirs out there in a sea of memoirs, right? I hope we've all read it. Hey, thank you for a lively political conversation. More to come.